Thanks for listening to A Long Time in Finance with Jonathan Ford and Neil Collins, in partnership with Briefcase News, the service that brings intelligent curation and analysis to your media monitoring. So we've been doing a series on what we call fallen angels, meaning companies that failed or messed up. And we've been looking in the last few weeks at golden oldies like ICI, the chemical company, and the electrical giant GEC. But then we thought, goodness, there's a much more contemporary example in the water sector, and it's a company called Thames Water. Now, Thames was privatised in 1989 with no debts at all, but now it has borrowings of more than £15 billion and the vultures are circling. It needs to repay a £190 million loan by the end of this month, and there are questions about whether it has the cash to do so. The owners, a bunch of international pension and infrastructure funds, have been asked to put in more equity to shore up the balance sheet. But an offer by them to inject £500 million has been hedged around with demands, which include raising water bills by 56% in coming years and also getting let off any sewage spills that they make into the rivers, because that would be too difficult. These are seen as politically difficult for the regulator, or indeed the government, to accede to. And the price of bonds issued by the company has fallen to pennies in the pound. Now, Thames isn't like an ordinary company which just has to make its way the best it can. There are rules, and under some 2010 laws, it can be put into special administration if it's no longer a going concern. It could then have its balance sheet restructured or be passed to a new entity, either in the private or public sector. So in this episode, gasp, we thought we'd talk to Fergal Sharkey, an old friend of the show, former pop star, frontman of the Undertones, fisherman, and now ferocious campaigner on all things water. So welcome, Fergal.
Gentlemen, it's lovely to see you as always. Thank you for the invitation.
So I think there are three big questions we have to tackle. One is, to what extent is this the product of privatisation and the way it was done? Second, is the regulator, known as Ofwat, the author of this terrible mess? And lastly, what should we now do about it? Should it be restructured in the private sector, or should we admit defeat and take it under public ownership? So let's start with the first one, Fergal. What's your view about the history of all this?
Well, just to be quite deferential here, I don't think it's actually about privatisation per se versus nationalisation. Has this privatisation failed? Absolutely, yes, it has, without a doubt. The mere fact we're even having this conversation, looking at the challenges the industry overall has had and is going to have, the amount of money needed, you may have been aware, last week, government announced we are going to need to find another 4.8 billion litres of water a day just to keep London's taps running, and to do that within the next 20 years. The whole sewage crisis, the whole thing is in a complete and utter mess. So yes, has this privatisation failed? No exceptions. Yes, it has.
Well, I would say there are exceptions. I would say the exceptions are the relatively better managed businesses, which are still listed companies, where the market has not allowed them to play fast and loose with the balance sheet the way it has with the Macquarie and private equity people. The remaining listed water companies, I would say, are far from being basket cases. They have made mistakes, but I don't think they are beyond redemption.
So the water sector was privatised. Everyone was in the public markets. Then over time, of the nine English companies, I think six have ended up basically being owned by really nowadays what are called special infrastructure funds or sovereign wealth companies, and three remain on the stock market. So that's where we are now.
Please bear in mind, water companies have a statutory obligation to build, operate and maintain a properly functioning sewage system. And that's not just me. That's Ofwat's letters writing, reminding the companies of that is the business you're in. That's what the law requires of you. Another layer, I'm afraid, Ofwat also now acknowledges, and the industry has confirmed it, we have provided them all of the funding they ever needed for 33 years to meet that legal obligation. Clearly, they didn't spend it on the sewage system. A question we should be asking, what happened to our money? Where's it gone? And when can we all have a refund?
Well, I don't think there's much chance of a refund. And most of the damage has been done by replacing equity with debt. And the debt is now at Thames, if we can concentrate on that, over £15 billion, which is a sort of sum which would be quite useful to have if you invested it in the business. I would say that that is got to be the way forward, but I'm jumping ahead a bit.
Again, to give you another flavour of this, Neil, the side issue along with that is the shortage, water shortage London is facing. The National Infrastructure Commission a couple of months ago now put a figure on it. We're going to need another $60 billion just to now try and maintain and build the infrastructure and the resources needed to secure and maintain London's water supply. And we need to do that in the next 20 to 25 years.
I just want to quickly put a bit of historical perspective. One is Thames Water, along with all the other water companies, was listed on the stock market with no debt in 1989. Thames Water's journey since then, obviously the idea was that it would use this fiscal headroom to invest a lot in water activities. Its trajectory, though, over the medium term has been one of debt, which has, if you like, outpaced the investment that's gone into the business. And a few years ago, when I was at the Financial Times, we did a kind of investigation looking into the finances of the water companies, which actually showed that they could have funded all the capex that they did out of operating cash flows without taking on debt. But we are where we are. One of the reasons, of course, we are where we are is that the water regulator, out of a desire to reduce the cost of water to the public, basically was quite willing to see companies increase their debts, take on quite large debts, if that meant that the cost of capital which they had to pay was reduced. And that was deemed as something which could be passed through to the water customers. But of course, what we've ended up with is the worst of all worlds, which is that we now have a system where there's not much capacity to borrow anymore to put in any additional infrastructure, and the cost of debt has been shooting up.
I hold no candle for Thames Water, but they have been trying to build a reservoir to deal with this forthcoming shortage for about 30 years now, and they are blocked by the regulations which have stopped them doing it. You can't really blame them for failing to try and plan ahead on that front. The other point I think is worth making when we're having a go at Ofwat is that in the last pricing round, they imposed or tried to impose a figure on Thames to Ofwat.
Picking up on Jonathan's point, yes, I have enormous empathy for the water companies in that Ofwat was clearly on a drive to, quote, to ensure the company sweated the assets, that they drove that infrastructure into the ground and drove every last penny out of it. That potentially has created the situation where, A, we're now leaking 20% of all of the water supplied every day just through infrastructure leaks. And indeed, here in southern England right now, where I'm down in Hampshire, the sewage system now has become so dysfunctional, the groundwater is now seeping into the sewage system, overwhelming the system, and that's why there's now endless tankers driving sewage up and down the country. I think ultimately, for me, the really kind of naive thing that Ofwat got involved in was what they refer to as reputational regulation. That they've been running this campaign for decades now. If they named and shamed these companies enough in public, that in itself would do something to alter, shift and impact the behavior pattern of these companies. And for me, it was not akin to just a bunch of 17-year-old O-level economic students having some playtime little debate during the lunch hour, trying to create what looked like a functioning market in what ultimately is a state-granted monopoly.
I think the other point, though, to pick up on Neil's desire to be fair to the regulator, and this also draws in, I think, another organisation you have not a lot of time for, which is the Environment Agency, is the very low level of financial penalties for water companies that did not fulfill the kind of high standards which the regulator was and the Environment Agency were claiming they were meeting. So there were tiny fines of a few £100,000 for massive leaks. And of course, that has now changed and they've ramped those up dramatically. But of course, the horse has potted off out of the stable some time ago. And now, of course, the companies are very anxious about not having the money to pay these enormous fines because the problems are just baked into the system.
When you had the responsibility divided between DEFRA, the Environment Agency, and Ofwat, nothing could possibly go wrong.
Was that a small minor undertone of, see the way I did that, undertone of sarcasm?
Oh, very good. Surely not.
It's very rare for that to happen.
Listen, I think you're absolutely right. Whether or not it physically happened, I've always been very sensitive to the political nod that low bills was actually the expectation politically, is, let's face it, which government wants to get labelled by simply adding another indirect tax onto an overburdened system and overburdened households as we already have?
I have to say, I think that privatisation was based on a myth. And this is my overarching, boring philosophical view. And this was what was sold to the companies which bought into it, was that this was a technocratic system where effectively the kind of political element of water prices could be removed by the substitution of a clever algorithm which no one in the public, general public, would understand. As a consequence, they were led to believe that they would be able to run their affairs pretty much as they chose, and the kind of usual odium which attaches to private monopolies would not apply. And so therefore, they were able to tell their own shareholders, this is great, you know, we've got these stable income, it's going to be fantastic, we can leverage it, we can make lots of money. And to be honest, that's a myth. It is a political issue. You now see it very, very clearly. When Thames Water's shareholders have been trying to haggle over putting in more money into essentially what looks pretty much like a insolvent company, the government is very much standing behind, and the regulator is very conscious of its political role in deciding whether or not to grant a 56% increase in water prices going forward as the price for more money coming in. It's just a myth that these things are somehow, you know, removed from political oversight.
Well, it's impossible to remove it from political oversight, right. But I would disagree with quite a lot of that. Because it's perfectly possible to run it, provided you have a regulator with teeth, provided you have a system which does not allow companies to bet the farm on interest rates and borrowing.
But where we differ, Neil, is I think the reason the regulator didn't have teeth was because it knew the political demands that the government placed on it, which is don't put up water bills, find ways to keep them down, don't take people's licenses away, because everyone was invested in the idea that any failure, any removal of a license, any insolvency would discredit the whole system, which was designed to be a perpetual profit-making machine.
So we're agreed that the situation today is not great. I wonder what the Starkey solution is.
Ironically enough, it's what's making this whole situation so utterly explosive at this minute in time. Thames Water's looking for 56%. We're talking about Macquarie, current owners of Southern Water, and in real terms, by 2030, they're looking for a 70% increase in bills to their customers.
Who?
Southern Water, Macquarie. And here's the thing. As a government, you really want to be grappling with that in the run-up to an election that's not looking great anyway, and you're about to remotely grant permission for customers' bills to be put up anywhere. Remotely, like 56%, never mind 70%. The timing, from my perspective, the political timing could not be more perfect, because it's dragging the whole ugly mess out into the table for proper public scrutiny and debate.
It seems to me that there is actually quite a lot of scope for compromise here, given the various interests. The first one is that the shares in Thames Water are effectively worthless. The $15 billion of debt is worth a great deal less than $15 billion, and the people who hold that are going to have to take a haircut. We can argue about how much, but say $10 billion would be enough to recapitalise Thames Water, because it would transform the balance sheet. And to encourage them to do that, they would have to have some sort of concession on the sewage fines and some sort of price increase, but it would be a good deal less than 70%.
Sorry, who's this incentive for?
This is an incentive for the owners of the company and the bondholders to negotiate and settle.
But you see, here's the thing, Neil. As the Supreme Court adjudicated last year in the case of Northern Rock, the share price of a company that is effectively bankrupt is nothing, and then the shareholders get nothing. So we could actually nationalize or take state control of, bear with me, take state control of Thames Water tomorrow, and that would not cost the taxpayer a penny. Now you then move on to, well, how do we deal with it? And where do we raise the money, not only to secure London's water supply, but to fix the sewage system? And ironically enough, there's a number of ways that that could be done. All of it involves no intervention from the taxpayer, because personally, I don't think the taxpayer should put another penny into these companies. But you are right, they will need restructured. And it's not so much about the ownership model, whether that turns out to be a mutual or as they stay as privatized companies. It's about how we actually then ensure they've got access to the finance, even if that means the government guaranteeing the bond to the market for the sum of money that was needed to be raised to go and build the thing.
So what happens to the bondholders in your scenario?
Oh, they're going to take a bath.
Oh, right.
I have only two words: due diligence.
Yeah, no, listen, I think we're agreed on that. But if they took a £10 billion haircut, the finances of the business, not the company, the finances of the business would be transformed. They wouldn't need government money.
I mean, I agree. Their shareholders are pretty much out of the conversation.
Yeah.
You know, they're just sort of sitting squawking on the sidelines. But the bondholders have an issue, which is you write them down to 5 billion from 15 or whatever it is that's necessary to get there. They're not exactly going to be pumping your hand with pleasure. They're going to be looking a bit sad. But they are going to say, well, that's fair enough. We'll take that. But the business needs money. You know, we can shrink to some extent into our skin, but any future capital injections required, who's going to provide those? And the bondholders may well say, we're not very enthusiastic owners of this equity. In which case, the government will probably, faute de mieux, in the absence of some sort of negotiated settlement, have to take responsibility. I would be quite tough if I was the government. I would say, to be honest, this private monopoly could really do with a restructure, and an insolvency, for all its ugly effects on other companies in the sector, which will undoubtedly put their cost of capital up a bit, which is not good news, does offer an opportunity in the case of Thames to think about whether there's a better way to go about this. And I think it would be a mistake not to at least think about that.
Thames is a hugely cash flow positive business, and I think if it was properly restructured, then the money would come forward. The markets have lent 100-year money to Mexico, which I think has defaulted about 15 times in the last 50 years. You know, that's what happens in the markets. It's a triumph of hope over experience.
So we don't need a deal. We can just...
No, we need a deal.
Why?
No. You need a deal. You need a deal to have carrots for the new owners of the business, yeah, who are the previous bondholders.
Ironically enough, I'm in total agreement with both of you.
What a diplomat.
Splendid fellow.
Government does need to play hardball. Because one way or another, this is, even if it is the bill payers, one way or another, it's the public's money we're talking about here. It's just what route it gets channeled. So government does need to play hardball. I'm a total optimist. And who would not want to run a state-granted monopoly supplying drinking water to 15 million people in the greater London area? There's a business in there somewhere. And at the back of it all, I think you're right. I think government might have to take that approach, Neil, even if we're going to let the company go back out to the bond market, even if government ends up guaranteeing those bonds 30, 40, 50, 100 years down the line, and providing that kind of assurance to the markets that if at some point in the future it all goes wrong, government will be there to pick up the slack and deal with it. But either way, it is going to take a firm hand and a lion's heart and an awful lot of passion and determination.
Can I make another suggestion, which is, at the very least, if I was the government — I'm now sounding like a crazed kind of Marxist, but there you go, what the hell — I would say, okay, you can go into special administration if that's where they end up, but I would want to reissue the license and issue a new license, rather than working with what is clearly, in my view, a flawed document, which has either not been enforced or has been wrongly written in the first place. I would want to effectively set a better template. The one thing we really did with all of this was we said to people with a natural private monopoly like water, where most other people who had privatized it had done it on a concessionary basis, so they just gave an operating right to someone to have a crack for 10 years. We basically handed over all the assets, and the great advantage of the concessionaire, the privatized owner, is that they could mortgage the assets. And guess what? 20 years, 30 years later, we found they're all bloody in massive negative equity. Fantastic. Great result.
If you look at that, those operating licenses, you will see that there's actually no time limit to those licenses. If the Secretary of State wanted to revoke an operating license, they're now required to give the water company 25 years notice.
And why? Because they all took on 25-year bonds.
The argument water companies managed to persuade government to believe was such was the level of investment needed and such was the length of time needed to see a return on that investment, they needed to change the basic structure of the license to make it indefinite with a 25-year notice period. Bingo! I've now got 25 years worth of secure profit. I'll just put a load of debt under the balance sheet and pay it all through to myself as a massive dividend 25 years early. Hurrah!
That's very cynical, Fergal. I'm not going to comment on that. but why I think this is an unparalleled opportunity to think about this is Fergal has just brilliantly described the way in which the privatized operators are very good at changing the rules in their favor as they go along. It's always a problem. We haven't got enough money. We could make it cheaper only if, or it takes too long. And yet, if ever any attempt is made to redraw the rules in a way which is in any way inimical to their interests, the immediate response is, oh, you can't, you've changed the rules, it can't be touched. And that's nonsense. You can and should touch them.
I'm not sure it's necessary. I mean, the government has got some fairly high cards here. It can limit the price rises that they're allowed to impose. It can demonstrate that this is the sort of structure that it wants to see, and there's nothing to stop Ofwat being given more teeth if that's felt to be necessary. I mean, you know, it's quite a tricky poker game, this.
Ironically enough, Neil, since day one, Ofwat has had the power to issue an enforcement order, and if a water company does not comply with that enforcement order, Ofwat automatically is then granted the power to fine them anything up to 10% of their annual turnover. Guess how many enforcement orders Ofwat's issued over the last 33 years? That would be, as far as I can find out, none, nada, zero, zip. They've got all the teeth in the world. They just refuse to close their mouth and bite.
Unfortunately, I'm probably too old to apply for the job, but I think I could do it rather better.
He's still got all his own teeth. I suppose I'm a bit more cynical than Neil, amazingly. I find absolutely incredible that I'm saying this. What we have learned over the past 40 years is that this structure is not an optimal one. I think it's too complicated. I think the public don't really understand it. They don't understand how prices are set. I remember sitting in a room with a man with the splendid name of Johnson Cox, and he tried to explain to me over a two-hour conversation how he'd decided to set prices and why his new regime was so much tougher than the previous one. And at the end of it, I just sat there with my eyes contra-rotating in total despair. And I thought, I'm paid to try to understand this, and if I haven't got a clue what he's talking about, how is anyone ever going to understand it? So I think it's too complicated, too political, and the politics gets worse whenever there's a problem. Therefore, the gears always fall apart as soon as they confront a problem.
I have to say, Jonathan Ford, for a capitalist, you're becoming quite a socialist.
Yes, quite. That was A Long Time in Finance with Jonathan Ford and Neil Collins. Production and editing by Nick Hilton, and our sponsorship partner is briefcase.news. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review it on your podcast app, as that will help new listeners find us.